doing this series now. I've been calling it Followers Away 101. And it's good to go over. I can hardly remember without my notes, so let's look at what we've done so far. We started with the gospel, right? So we did the gospel, which was the kingship of Jesus. We did Sermon on the Mount, obedience. And then we did, we did sacraments and communion. I don't remember which order, but let's do it this way. Sacraments and intentional community. And then we did, the last one was, do you remember? No, practical holiness. I had talked about doing that in two parts, and I was going to look at some more, like, rubber meets the road holiness issues. I decided not to, and I hope you forgive me for that, because it would take me too long, and I want to keep going with this. What we're going to look at today is we want our communities to be socially responsible. What does that mean? Well, we'll look at it together. I'm somewhat of a student of the Christian communitarian movement, and if you have looked into that, you'll recognize that in the 70s and 80s, at least in America, there was some kind of resurgence of the Christian communitarian movement. I haven't seen anybody say this specifically, but my own thesis is that a lot of the people who were converted out of subculture in the 70s, particularly in the Jesus Freak movement, they went into their local, you know, Lutheran or Baptist churches, and they settled in off of their subculture into normal American Christianity and spent about 10 years there, and then they realized, hey, this radical Jesus that I signed up to follow, I'm not seeing that radical call. And so there's kind of a migration from mainstream evangelicalism, in part maybe due to the discipleship movement, but nonetheless, into some Christian communitarian movements. There are some notable ones, some that people know of, and some that, and tons that I'm sure people don't know of, but like Reba Place in Evanston, Illinois, was started, I don't know in what year, but sometime in the late 70s, early 80s. Jesus People, also in Chicago. There's a place called Koinonia Farms. There's just a few collaborative communitarian movements that begin to happen. And if you watch those movements, they are very socially responsible. But what often happens if you become a student of those movements is that they often fall apart in practical holiness. And so there's a corresponding kind of like, it's like an either or. You either get practically holy communities that emphasize obedience and self-denial and living apart from sin, or you get socially responsible communities that are very interested in the poor and their social responsibility of their community. It was almost like, as I look through modern church history, it's almost like you have to pick which one is more important to you and go to a place where they have that. And our desire and our thesis with Followers of the Way is that we can have both. We can have a practically holy community that is also socially responsible. And so it's important for me to put these two right next to each other so that we focus on them together, because they are kind of like, they are a balancing act. If you ever watch those old wire walkers, you know, they have those big, long balance poles that they carry. And I always wonder why such a big, long, like the guy that walks between the Twin Towers or walks across the Grand Canyon, these wire walkers would have these huge balance poles. And the further, like the tighter your walk is, the more you need balance. You can counterbalance, like, as long of a pole as you can hold with weights on both sides, like, you can use that weight to kind of keep you steady walking. That's why they had these big balance poles when they did wire walking. And the church is a wire walk. Like, the kingdom is a wire walk. It's a narrow way. And we need to have these counterbalances or else we fall apart. Yeah, I'll take that. Thank you. I do most of my study in digital, but I still don't like preaching without a Bible. But I forgot mine, so Elijah brought it for me. So let's take a look at what I mean by social responsibility and why I think it matters. There's a Christian disposition of separating from the world and creating new allegiances, calling people out of one order and into the order of the church. It has a tendency towards, like, we create our own little social bubbles, right? Within any given society where the church is, we kind of collect to ourselves, we make this subculture of the Christian church, and from the outside, that looks kind of alienating. I don't know how many of us have heard when we have come into these circles of churches that our friends and our families, they're worried about us, that we're taking things too far, or it feels kind of culty, like all you guys do is talk about your community and church and gospel stuff, like can you chill out a little bit? There's this like hesitation that people have with the church that we're on our own, that we're doing our own thing, that we're pulling away, that it's cultic. And that's not new. That is not a new phenomenon. The world has, I don't say always, but there's a very long pedigree for that criticism that the church is this isolated enclave and it's separated too much from the world. One of the earliest written arguments against the Christian community is that of Celsus. It's a work called The True Doctrine. That work, as far as I can tell, doesn't exist anymore, but Origen responds to it in a work that he called Contra Celsus, against Celsus in English. And he records many of Celsus's objections to the Christian community. It's a little bit debated. Some say Celsus was writing 175, 180 maybe. Origen's responding a little bit later. But this is a very early critique of the isolation of the Christian community. And if we look at what Celsus is saying, now Celsus is a philosopher in the Roman world, we don't know if he was Roman or Greek, but he has a list of critiques against Christianity. Some of them are doctrine, like he thinks the virgin birth is dumb and that we're just making up stories. He has other problems with Christian theology, but the practical arguments are the things that are most interesting to me. If you sum up Celsus's practical arguments, he says that the Christian community is disobedient to the state, because they won't partake in civil religion. There's a connection in Celsus's mind between civil religion and civil order. So the fact that everybody in the Roman Empire has some kind of allegiance, some kind of religious fidelity to the emperor and to the cult of the emperor keeps the Roman society in order, the empire in order. And because the Christians and by extension also the Jews won't partake in that civil religion, they're a threat to the civil order. To that, there's not much we can say. I'm sorry, we're not going to, is basically the answer. We don't bow to the idols, certainly not of Caesar. He also claims that that the Christian community disregards civil duties. He makes a critique in general that says, you guys are too much on your own. You're too separate. You do your own things your own way, and you're not a part of the common community. He says that the Christian church undermines traditional values. A quote from this is, you forbid Christians to kill anyone. You make them unwilling to serve as soldiers. And if all men were to act the same as you, there'd be nothing to prevent the emperor from being left alone and deserted. And the affairs of the earth would fall into the hands of the most lawless and savage barbarians. That's Origen's recorded criticism by Celsus. He also blames the church for social division by establishing a call to separate from family and and nation in order to be a part of the Christian community, to put our faith above that of other allegiances, he finds socially disruptive and divisive. And he thinks that the Christian community is encouraging rebellion. That's an observational criticism of the Christian community all the way back to the early second century. And I think if we have to be honest, we could say that our neighbors could make some of those criticisms of us. You're a strange group of people. You have your own ways. You don't blend in certain important civil religious obligations like, you know, standing for the national anthem or pledging allegiance to the flag or voting. Like, these things functionally today, these are civil religion. It's why, you know, I've talked about this before, but it's why everybody's supposed to vote. There's a mythology around how this empire is run that says everybody has to take part so that everybody will obey by play by the rules. And so the democratic process is this civil/religious engagement where you partake in the affairs of state so that you'll be bound by the affairs of state. And it's hard to accept, just like it was for Celsus, that we could choose to subject ourselves to the matters of state without taking the reins on our own selves. In the modern context, in the American democratic context, the idea that we would be willing to resign ourselves, submit ourselves to the decisions of the state without wanting to utilize, to use that for our own good, is something that doesn't make sense to the world around us. And so our refusal to participate in those processes, whether it's the Pledge of Allegiance or the voting booth, whatever those are, people look at that and they say, oh, you're a danger to the order, because you're not playing by the rules. You're not doing the things that we all do to keep this empire in order. Origen has some important answers to Celsus in his day. He underscores that the Christians pray for the emperor. Tertullian makes a similar statement later when he says, we consider Caesar more our Caesar than yours because he's established by God. And so we recognize the power and the authority of the Caesar because his authority is derived from God. And so when we submit to the Caesar, we're submitting to our God. And so the claim is made by both Origen and Tertullian that we are, in fact, submissive to the powers that be. We are under the domain of the civil structure. He says that, this is one of my favorite quotes of Origen. He says, we recognize in each state the existence of another national organization founded by the word of God. And we pray to the God of the universe for the king and for his friends and for the members of the royal family and for the government that they may be prosperous in all things and govern the state rightly. This is directly from Paul himself when he says to pray for kings and rulers, to give honor where honor is due and tribute where tribute is due and custom where custom is due. Playing by the rules is an important part of our social responsibility. That our good is not evil spoken of, that we do things by the rules. We do not see ourselves as out from under the domain of the society that we live in. We're not different. We'll pay our taxes, we'll do things according to the rules, we'll be upstanding citizens in that regard. Origen also says that moral integrity and good behavior of the Christians is exemplary to the rest of the society. Christians are taught not to lie, to avoid fraud and theft, and to be kind and considerate to their fellow beings. He says this is an example to all citizens. And I'm going to make my own list here for Origen, but just for the sake of following his line of reasoning, our moral character should be exemplary. In this day, just as it was in Origen's, we should be able to make the claim that the Christian community is our people of exemplary morals, that anybody can look on the character and behavior of the Christian community and see that we are good for the world around us, that we are an example and a model. He turns Celsus's argument on its head when he says that you subject the world to danger by teaching people not to kill. Origen says that our example of peacemaking is is also another example of morality that the world is good, is well served by. We do not put up even the smallest resistance when we are examined and taken away, although we do not deny our religion. We only defend ourselves by reminding those who persecute us that we have done them no wrong. He says we contribute to the common good by caring for the poor, by our acts of piety. And he says we have respect for the law, and we're a witness to the world through our examples. So this whole argument is being played out in the first few centuries of the church, and I want to just remind us that it's also being played out for us, that this contest, this problem, this dynamic is not any different in our day than it was in Origins and for the early church. We also have a liability. So where you'll often encounter this particular dilemma is when we talk about non-resistance. And I don't know how many times you've heard this, but I've heard it tons of times when we begin to talk about non-resistance as a Christian virtue of following Jesus. People will often say, well, if everyone acted like that, then dot, dot, dot. Then the criminals would overrun the country, or Hitler would have overrun Europe, or whatever the case may be that's made for why we need to exercise violence in order to preserve society. And then, very close after that, the accusation will come, so you are willing to live under the protection of those who will use violence. You'll receive the benefits of a violent society, but you won't partake in that violence. You want to keep yourself clean from it, but benefit from it. This is very commonly the way that this issue of what is your value, the question being asked is, how do you justify your value within the society in which you live? And if you don't have an answer for that question, it can be very discouraging, right? Like, that whole conversation about why do you get to benefit off of a violent empire? Why all of our dollars are soaked in blood money. Like, it's all, there's a violent empire that exists to allow us to live in the ease and comfort of this empire. So who are we in respect to the empire? Who are we to be here and in a place where that's the nature of the order that's over us, and we're saying we don't like that. We don't want to have anything to do with that. So how are you justifying your existence within this empire? This is the question of a socially responsible church. And it would be very easy, and some people have done this, to just pull away and to enclave, to make our own little separatist communities. This is a very, within the scope of like Christian communitarianism, it's a very common impulse that when people want to gather in Christian community, they will often do that in remote, isolated environments, and it's kind of like a retreat and withdrawal from the world. Like, okay, the world is going to hell, we're just going to go create our own little utopia. We'll have this is literally the utopian movement, especially in the late 1800s, early 1900s, of people, Christian communities who said, we don't want anything to do with what's happening out there. We're going to go create our own little perfect space, and we'll live our happy Christian lives as a quote-unquote witness to the world of how our order can be. Now, here's the challenge. Here's the challenge that we want to be. We want to be that social order, that quote-unquote utopian social order, but we want to put it right in the middle of the darkness and the brokenness of the world so that that becomes a witness, so that it becomes an opportunity, so that people can look into the Christian community from a place where they can actually see it and interact with it and experience it and see what we are offering to the world around us. And a part of what we offer are our lives of sacrifice and utility for our neighborhoods and our communities in the broader sense. Look with me, let's turn to Isaiah. The very first chapter. So in Isaiah chapter 1, I'm going to look at two chapters in Isaiah, and they both have a similar context. I mean, the contexts are very different, but they both have a similar point in that God is addressing through the prophet the sins of a people and trying to call them to something else. So let's read in Isaiah chapter 1, the vision of Isaiah, the son of Amoz, which he saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem in the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah. Hear, verse 2, hear, O heavens, and give ear, O earth, for the Lord hath spoken. I have nourished and brought up children, and they have rebelled against me. The ox knoweth his owner, and the ass his master's crib, but Israel doth not know, my people doth not consider. Ah, sinful nation, a people laden with iniquity, a seed of evildoers, children that are corruptors, they have forsaken the Lord, they have provoked the Holy One of Israel unto anger, they are gone away backwards. Why should you be stricken any more? You will revolt more and more. The whole head is sick, and the whole heart faint. From the sole of the foot even unto the head, there is no soundness in it, but wounds and bruises and putrefying sores. They have not been closed, neither bound up, neither mollified with ointment. Your country is desolate, your cities are burned with fire, your land strangers devoured in your presence, and it is desolate as overthrown by strangers. And the daughter of Zion is left as a cottage in a vineyard, as a lodge in a garden of cucumbers, as a besieged city. Except the Lord of hosts had left unto us a very small remnant, we should have been as Sodom, and we should have been like unto Gomorrah. Hear the words of the Lord, ye rulers of Sodom. Give ear unto the law of our God, ye people of Gomorrah. To what purpose is the multitude of your sacrifices unto me, saith the Lord? I'm full of the burnt offerings of rams and the fat of fed beasts, and I delight not in the blood of bullocks or of lambs or of he-goats. When you come to appear before me, who hath required this at your hand to tread my courts? Bring no more vain oblations. Incense is an abomination unto me. The new moons and Sabbaths, the callings of assemblies, I cannot away with. It is iniquity, even the solemn meeting. Your new moons and your appointed feasts my soul hateth. They are a trouble unto me. I'm weary to bear them. And when you spread forth your hands, I will hide mine eyes from you. Yea, when you make many prayers, I will not hear. Your hands are full of blood. Wash you and make you clean. So look, God in the Old Testament also has a discrete set apart people. He wants them to be something different. He wants them to be an image that the world can look at and see what he's trying to do in the world. There's some similarities in that regard. And in this case, he finally brings forth the prophet Isaiah to tell them, you're messing it all up. You're doing it all wrong. Everything I expected is you're doing the opposite of what I wanted out of you. And he gives this litany of sins that they're committing. Like it's just a picture over and over again for all those verses of how filthy and disgusting and wicked and vile Israel has become to God. And he says, even the religious things you do, they just make it worse. So what's the remedy? He says in verse 16, wash you, make you clean. Put away the evil of your doings from before mine eyes. Cease to do evil. Learn to do well. Seek judgment. Relieve the oppressed. Judge the fatherless. Plead for the widow. Come and let us reason together. Though your sins be as scarlet, they shall be white as snow. Though they be red like crimson, they shall be as wool. If ye be willing and obedient, you shall eat of the good of the land. But if you refuse and rebel, you shall be devoured with the sword, for the mouth of the Lord has spoken it. It's a really simple request that he has. He just wants them not to be oppressors. He just wants them to have an eye for innocence and goodness. That's the request. And that's the request of social responsibility. This is in the heart of God, deep, deep in the heart of God. There's many places where this same kind of principle gets played out, where God is saying, you're wicked, you're wretched, you're terrible. I want you to just be good. Do things my way. Care about what I care about. And namely, that often comes down to the poor, the widowed, the fatherless. People who have needs. And God is making a distinction over and over again in the Old Testament. He is defining righteousness and unrighteousness on the terms of whether or not his people care about those classes of people. And a church that doesn't care about those classes of people is like an Israel that doesn't care about those classes of people. The oppressed and the hungry and the naked and the imprisoned and the homeless, the fatherless, these are deep in the heart of who God loves. And he has commissioned his people in the Old Testament and in the New Testament to be the people who address those problems in his world. I was explaining to someone this week how the beginning narrative of what the Bible is, like the Bible story. It's a really awesome opportunity to be able to start with someone who knows nothing about the scriptures, who comes to you and says, tell me what the Bible says. Tell me the Bible story. And to be able to lay out what God's interests are in the narrative of the scriptures and point the way. Like, here's the important signs along the way of what God's doing with his people. One of those things is that God says, through the garden, this rapid descent into hell on earth from Adam and Eve's fall to their first children committing murder. Like, it's the very next generation after the garden are murderers. Like, that's how quick it goes. And then it's downhill from there. And God steps into that, into our mess that we've made of his good world, and says, I'll fix it. And his fixing it, in both the case of the Old Testament and the New Testament, is to rise up a people who are connected to him, who are under his name and under his protection and banner and provision to address the needs that are in the world around them. And it's all the more so in the Christian community because it's not just the image of Israel, it's that we are the body of Christ. That Christ is still on earth ministering to the very real needs of the people who are affected by sin. And he's calling you and me, brothers and sisters, he's calling you and me to be the one to help resolve the problems of sin in the world around us. And that is socially responsible. That is caring about the effects of sin in the people around us, in the people who we can touch and influence and change, so that their lives can be improved by Jesus' ministry on earth. I want to give my own list, like Origen did, of how we answer the criticism of what our value in the world around us is supposed to be. We should care. I'll write these down. We should care about poverty. There's, in every way, in big ways and small. What do you mean by that? I mean, don't turn your eyes away. This is, I've said it over and over again. Do not turn your eyes away from the poor. When you see somebody homeless, when you see somebody hurting, when you see somebody in need, when you see somebody desperate and destitute, do not look away. It is the easiest impulse of a man to look away when because we don't want to recognize, we don't want to see the effects of that brokenness. It is so easy to turn your eyes away from the poor. to roll up to the intersection and to get busy with your radio or your phone or look at the person that you're riding with and not the this destitute person who stands on the side of the road asking for help. And so then we salve our conscience and we say, well, they're probably rich anyhow. They're probably out here because this is how they make their money and they make more money than me. Or they're probably going to spend it on dope or alcohol or whatever else. Or they're probably whatever. All that stuff that you tell yourself, that's for you. That's just to salve your conscience for not giving to him that asketh you. If you have it, give it. If somebody's there, this is a command of Jesus, and it's what distinguishes us as his people. Give to him that asketh thee. And if you want to go the extra mile and you want to go use that money and buy some food because you're worried about those things, then go buy some food, take the time, go buy some food and bring food to the person. But give to him that asketh thee. If you can, if you have it, I'm not saying you always do. I'm not saying we need to live in guilt. I'm saying that we should be people who are known to give to those that ask. When there's a need presented to me and I can meet it, I will meet it. It's just a very simple choice to make as a disciple of Jesus. If I get the money in my pocket, I'm going to give them something. I don't know how many times I've failed at that, but I feel guilty. When I drive by somebody or walk by somebody who's asking for money, I say, no, I don't got any cash on me. And then I realize, I did have cash on me. Or I know that I have cash on me, and I'm like, I want to get a coffee, or I got to go do something, or whatever else. I mean, it's exactly, he that is faithful in that which is least is faithful also much. And he that is unjust in that which is least is unjust also much. And if we aren't the kind of people who can give a few dollars to somebody who's in a desperate enough situation, I don't care. At least it's poverty of spirit that they're living in a place where they have to ask strangers for money. What does it cost us to give a few dollars? What it costs is that it costs care. It costs involvement. It costs stopping my life for long enough to say, I'll get involved. And it's not just with these. There's other kinds of poverty. There's poverty, like, I don't know, maybe I attract this kind of stuff, but I don't know if you've ever just been walking around or on a train or on a bus somewhere and somebody is just bawling because something's broken in their life and they're a mess. And everybody, if this happens on the train, everybody just like, ugh, I don't want anything to do with that. I wonder what's going on with her, that poor thing. What's it cost to go over to somebody that's in that situation and say, hey, are you okay? I care about you. I'd like to help if I can. We have to get involved. If we don't do it, nobody's going to. We're the ones that God has sent here. This is our mission and our purpose, to get involved in broken lives. And we have all moved here to this city because it's a place of brokenness. Because there's plenty of opportunity and needs for what God wants to do in people's lives. And if we miss those opportunities and we don't step in, we don't do the very bare minimum of at least trying to help, why are we here? It's our job. We have a debt and an obligation. Those are the little ways, but there's big ways too. What about investing in poverty relief? What about investing in microloan programs? What about investing in charities that are trying to work on these issues? I know you brothers and sisters do. I'm not rebuking anybody. I'm just saying, in small and large ways, we should be investing in creating a better world. Social responsibility is caring for the poor. They are, let's say it this way, they are our responsibility. And I've said it before, I'll say it again. this is not primarily, although it can be, this is not primarily an evangelistic endeavor. Let's do it this way. What I mean by that is it's good to feed people because they're hungry. I don't care what their worldview is. I don't care if they'll listen to me talk about Jesus. I don't care if they're Buddhists, Hindus, atheists. I don't care. It is intrinsically valuable to God to feed hungry people. Regardless, it feels weird to me, and I've done it a lot of the years. Like, I come out of street ministry, I come out of missions work. I mean, working at the mission, the gospel missions, where you have to listen to a sermon before you can get your food. At least that's how it used to be back in the day. And it just feels weird to leverage people's hunger to get them to listen to you about what you think is right in the world or your worldview. I don't like it. Feed them. If they're interested, they'll ask. That's how I feel. The next thing we should be interested in as socially responsible Christians is peacemaking. We should have, in the case of poverty, we should have different attitudes. About possessions. Are you different than your neighbors in the way that you feel about your possessions? The Christian community, because we care about poverty, should have, and a bunch of other things, should have different attitudes about possessions. Our possessions, we should hold in a different place than the world. And this is what happens in Acts. When the first Christian communities arise, one of the first marks of the Holy Spirit working among this people that will be called the Christians is that they take on a different orientation in regards to their possessions. Their possessions become means to an end, not an end in of themselves. Their possessions become a way to perform a task for their God. And so if my possessions are useful to the community, if they're useful to God, however they're best used is what I want, is now my relationship with my possessions. And so heaping them up to myself doesn't make sense anymore. Not caring about other people's needs doesn't make sense anymore. I have a different attitude about my possessions. In peacemaking, we have a different attitude about conflict. That conflict becomes opportunity. Avoidance is not the object. Avoidance is not the goal. To not be in conflict at any cost is not the goal. To see the opportunity in conflict becomes the goal. How can we use this conflict for the purposes of God? How can we find resolution? How can we do something with conflict to make it change? See, in the cross, what we have, I've described this before, is that before Jesus' cross, before Jesus' teaching, the rule of God's people was an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And this is not enjoining justice. Justice is intrinsic. I think because we're made in God's image, we have a sense of justice, and all people have. Hittites have, Persians have, Hindus have, everybody has, all humans have a sense of justice, that something is right and something is wrong in a social sense, that it's terrible when the poor are abused and trodden out, whatever the case may be. There's some sense of justice, and especially about me, there's justice. Like, if you do me wrong, then something wrong should happen to you. That feels just. If you hurt people, you should be hurt. That feels just. The Mosaic provisions of an eye for an eye are a limit on retributive justice. It's not inventing retributive justice. Retributive justice is not new to the Jews. All kinds of ancient codes of law enjoin some kind of definition of a crime and definition of a penalty. What Moses does that's somewhat unique is that it limits that retributive justice. It says that if you take my tooth, I'm only going to take one of your teeth, not six of them. Because the impulse of man is if you take one of my teeth, I'll take six of yours. You take my eye, I'll take both of yours. And Moses is saying, no, you got to put a limit on it. Like, it has to be equal, or it makes more brokenness in the world. Jesus says, we've been doing that for millennia. We've been doing the eye for an eye thing for millennia, and there's no less evil in the world. What I'm going to do, and what my people are going to do, I'm going to be the model through the cross, is that I'm going to take wrong done, and I'm not going to put any wrong back out. I'm going to be like an exchanger of evil for good, of hate for love. Like, I'm going to exchange brokenness for health. I'm going to exchange disease for health. I'm going to exchange hatred for love. I'm going to convert what's broken in the world into wholeness. And that conversion actually makes a substantial difference in what and the amount of brokenness and evil that there is in the world. It's the first time that somebody specifically enjoins removing evil out of the world. We through the dictates of cross-bearing and enemy love, are taking evil out of the system. Because of the Christian community, there is literally less evil in the world than there would have been otherwise, because we take it out, just like Jesus' cross does. And we follow that model, we follow that example, and we too take evil out of the world. So when I see conflict, and when I see violence, and when I see hate, where is my opportunity to convert those things so that there's less of it in the world? And a part of this is having an eye for it. A part of this is seeing it where it is and getting involved. I feel like it's a little bit of a dangerous thing to say, because this is not what I'm talking about is not a no risk proposition. What I mean by that is that if you or I are walking down the street in Boston and a fight breaks out between two guys in the corner, the choice is to get as far away as soon as you can or to try to get involved. And I want to tell us that we should get involved, that we should step in the way, that we should say, hey, what's going on? Hey, come on, guys, there's a different way to deal with this. Please stop. I'm not going to watch this happen. Hey, and get in the middle. But I also know that that's a really dangerous thing to do. That somebody can pull a knife, somebody can get hit, somebody can get hurt. But I think that we are supposed to be the people who step in the way. We all know this. We all say this stuff. Peacemaking, non-resistance and peacemaking is not avoiding. It's not cowering. It should be, under its proper terms and definitions, the opposite of cowardice. It should not be running away. It should be stopping and seeing and getting involved. And I don't know how to prepare for that. I don't know what that means. I don't know what you're supposed to do in that situation. But my impulse and my better nature, my Christian nature, says that we should get involved. That you'll figure it out when you get there. But I don't want to say that without recognizing that that's a real risk that we take. That especially in terms of stepping into physical violence, and threats, that those things could cost us some real pain. But it includes people being harassed and bullied and yelled at. And again, I don't know if I track these kinds of things, but I come across these situations from time to time in the city, on the train, on the block, where somebody's being yelled at or screamed at. And there's, just like with the poor, there's this impulse to just turn away and be like, I don't want any of that problem. It's not my problem. I could get around the corner and get away from this. But there's a better impulse inside of me that says, I should figure out if somebody's going to get hurt and if they need help and what I can do to be involved. Actively helping is earning our place in the world. There's a more personal way of being involved in peacemaking that is a skill where we learn to listen well and we learn to find solutions. We help people feel heard, and we apply creative ways to actually solve problems. It's socially responsible to solve interpersonal conflicts, whether they're within the church or without the church. You know, the nice thing is that within the church, we have a common set of values that we should be able to appeal to with each other to find solutions. And we know how hard that's been, that even among our own people, our own worldview, our own common values, it's hard enough to find solutions to conflict. But we should lean in, brothers and sisters. We should continue leaning in to those conflicts and learning how to listen and learning how to understand people and why they're at different places and finding creative solutions to people's problems. It's socially responsible to be involved in community and culture. Here again, you know, there's this contrasting impulse. I want to bail out on culture because there's a lot of things about our culture that I detest, that I think God detests. And it's easy to have kind of isolationist perspective with culture, that American culture is bankrupt and morally broken and decayed, and just to throw out the baby with the bathwater. But the fact of the matter is, we're all Americans. We all live in this country, in this broader national community, and in these specific neighborhoods, and these specific places. And there are good things about our culture. I think it's myopic, it's ignorant, to think that all our whole culture is all bad or that it's all good. I think wisdom dictates, and the proper response, whether we're in first century Rome or 21st century America or anywhere in between, to be able to have an accurate critique and blessing to the good things and the bad things that are present in our culture. Because the good things in our culture are opportunities to endorse and to support and to be partakers, to be involved. So what are those things? I feel like I'm speaking too theoretically. So what's some good things about our culture? Well, it happens to be that in the modern West, there's ideas that, I don't know, that the government shouldn't watch children starve and have no health care. Good for them. It's fantastic. That's a relatively modern idea that we can be glad for, that the West has become wealthy enough that they just don't think children should go without food and medicine. Praise God. That's great. We should encourage that. I don't mean voting, whatever. Just say it's good. Just endorse that idea. It's good that there's infrastructure. It's good that there's communities. It's good that there's libraries. It's good that there's schooling for children who don't have anywhere to go to school. Like, there's lots of good things that happen around us. And I feel like in my own personal life, I was so against that I couldn't see the good that was around me. And that's not wise. It doesn't match the needs of the day. It doesn't allow me to connect with people and endorse something that we should hold a common value around. But there are also horrible things about our culture. And people getting dragged into the left-right paradigm and nationalism and all these horrible things. We should be able to see right and wrong. But more specifically, we should be actively helping and earning our place. We should be good neighbors. In a world where people don't know their neighbors, we should know our neighbors. We should be engaged. We should knock on some doors and say, hey, I'm your neighbor. I had an experience. Here's a good example. Don't miss an opportunity. My cat got away, and it ended up on a social media site, and I saw a picture of my cat. I said, does anybody know who this cat is? Yeah, it's my cat. She's back now, but thanks for putting that out there. I'm always afraid because animal people are weird, and I didn't know if it was animal people or what, but I just, like, yeah, it's my cat. Thanks for putting it out there. She's home now. It's great. So she sent me a message. She said, oh, we're your neighbors across the fence. There's an opportunity. Hey, that's great. Thanks so much for putting that up with the cat. I'd love to get to meet you sometime. By the way, I've been thinking it'd be really nice to have some kind of like local communication for a neighborhood. I don't know all my neighbors, but I know everybody that is like in contact with my house and now behind my fence. It'd be really nice to have like a WhatsApp group or an email chain or something so that we can communicate directly with the neighbors. That kind of like building of community is a fantastic thing. Like knowing everybody in your building and having an email chain for everybody in the building. Does anybody know where this package is or where it went or whose cat got out or what? That kind of like just connectedness, I feel like used to be par for the course. You just used to know the people because there were durable neighborhoods and pre-gentrification, all these other issues. But now it's a scarce commodity that people even know who lives around them. And so we can build community and culture by being active agents to promote those kinds of things. It's just being a good neighbor. It's modeling how a good neighbor should be. And that's our responsibility. The same way we should be good citizens, we should be helpful in bettering the world around us. There's some brothers and sisters who are starting to do, I don't know how long they're going to do it for, but the last couple weeks, I don't know if you've heard about this, but there's a group of brothers and sisters who are going out and picking up trash on Wednesdays. That's great. It's fantastic. I hope they're known. I hope they get fame for being people who pick up trash and make their neighborhood better and cleaner. It's a wonderful example of social responsibility. Nobody's doing it. We see it. We'll take care of it. At the heart of this is the golden rule. It's hard to be an isolationist when God defines our obligation, when Jesus defines our obligation to love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength, and your neighbor as yourself. How am I going to be an isolationist if I'm supposed to love my neighbor like myself? That's socially responsible. And just to round it out, I think these two are related very often, but an eye to the oppressed. We live in a global world. The American Empire is the closest stand-in for the Roman Empire. It is the international power of the world, and our access to information causes us to know of where oppression is happening. And just like turning your eyes from the poor, turning your eyes from oppressed, listen, it's just depressing. And I get to the place where I can't look anymore. Like sometimes I look long enough that I can't look anymore. I can only take so much video footage and drone footage of Gaza until I just can't contain it. I can't hold on to the pain. So I know that there's a limit, but you can't ignore it either. We can't pretend like it's not happening. And what am I going to do about Gaza? What am I going to do about the Iraq War 20 years ago? Who am I to have anything to do with the Syrian refugee crisis? What am I supposed to do about the Rohingya or Rwanda or any of these things? And you can easy spin out so much on these horror stories and dive into the trauma and tragedy of the human experience so far that you can hardly see the light of day. And I don't recommend that. But I also can't recommend just pretending like it's not happening. I can't recommend not caring. And I can't recommend not praying. It's important to know at the local level and the international level where we can know that people are being oppressed, because it should affect our prayers. It should affect the way we think about the world. Like, it's easy to live in this blissful world where just America's great and the rest of the world, I don't know. I don't care. Like, I got my life. Like, it's okay for me. And I'm busy, and I got stuff going on, and it's easy to not care about what's happening. It's easy to not care about the misery that many, many people are living in. And we can't do that. There is, you know, the appeals of the early church is that their prayers contributed to mitigating and minimizing evil in the world around them. And if nothing else, we have an obligation to pray against the demons that stir up strife among men and cause violence and war. It's a spiritual battle that we should be engaging in, that we have a prerogative and an obligation to do. And we should remind each other to pray and to fast for those things. Flip over to, this is the other chapter I wanted to look at, Isaiah 58, and you know it. It's the fast that's pleasing to the Lord. Cry aloud in Isaiah 58, spare not. Lift up thy voice like a trumpet and show my people their transgressions. See the same connection? I expected my people to do certain things and to be certain things, and they're not. Show my people their transgressions and the house of Jacob their sins, yet they seek me daily and delight to know my ways. As a nation that did righteousness and forsook not the ordinance of their God, they ask of me the ordinances of justice. They take delight in approaching to God. Wherefore have we fasted, say they, and thou seest not? Wherefore have we afflicted our soul, and thou takest no knowledge? Behold, in the day of your fast you find pleasure and exact all your labors. Behold, you fast for strife and debate, and to smite with the fist of wickedness. You shall not fast as you do this day, to make your voice to be heard on high. Is it such a fast I have chosen, a day for a man to afflict his soul? Is it to bow down his head as a bulrush and to spread sackcloth and ashes under him? Wilt thou call this a fast and an acceptable day to the Lord? If not, is not this the fast that I have chosen? To loose the bands of wickedness, to undo the heavy burdens, and to let the oppressed go free, and that ye break every yoke? Is it not to deal thy bread to the hungry, and that thou bring the poor that are cast out to thy house? When thou seest the naked, that thou cover him,
and that thou hide not thyself from thine own flesh. Then shall thy light break forth as the morning, and thine health shall spring forth speedily, and thy righteousness shall go before thee. The glory of the Lord shall be thy reward. Then shalt thou call, and the Lord shall answer. Thou shalt cry, and he shall say, Here I am. If thou take away from the midst of thee the yoke, the putting forth of the finger, and speaking vanity, and if thou draw out thy soul to the hungry and satisfy the afflicted soul, then shall thy light rise in obscurity, and thy darkness be as noonday. And the Lord shall guide thee continually, and satisfy thy soul in drought, and make fat thy bones, and thou shalt be like a water garden, and like a spring of water, whose waters fail not. My point in both of these chapters in Isaiah, because it expresses it so well, is that the way that God cares about broken, hurting, and needy people is the way that we are supposed to care about those same people. And that is a socially responsible community. If God took the time to enumerate these interests of his for the poor and the hungry and the needy, then we ought to be focusing in the same way. And we know that this is so because the last test at the judgment is the sheep and the goats. And I don't know how that's something that we all are going to face. This is not idealism. It's not like it would be nice if we could have this. It's a definition of who God's people are. And by the end, Jesus is going to say, when you saw me hungered and thirsty and naked and imprisoned, you took care of my needs. Or he's going to say, when you saw me that way, you didn't care for me. He's going to say that to you, and he's going to say it to me. And this is the thing to key your conscience to. This is what keeps you from turning your eye from the poor and from the oppressed. It's what gives you the strength and endurance to look into the brokenness of the world. The brokenness of the world can break your spirit. I have ridden the cusp of that dark pit where it feels too bad to continue observing a world that's this broken. If you care about the world, if you care about these kinds of things, if you watch the news about war and famine and pestilence, it can overwhelm your soul. And the thing that should encourage you, the thing that should allow you to endure that pain of empathy, that pain of acknowledging how broken the world is that is Christ's suffering. And I can't fix it all, but I have to fix what I can. I have to engage. I have to be involved because it's Christ. I'm going to close. With two reminders. James 1:27 says that pure religion and undefiled before God and the Father is this: to visit the fatherless and widows in their affliction and to keep himself unspotted from the world. And I want to encourage us as a socially responsible church and community to remember that how often we say the words, Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. And the things that we do to alleviate suffering and to care for the needy, they are our attempts to make God's will manifest on earth as it is in heaven. And when we say those and we repeat those and we recite that prayer that the Lord taught us to recite, that's the place where it happens, where we care for the oppressed, and where we meet people's needs
That's the place where we're making God's will reign on earth the way it is in heaven. So God give us grace and encouragement to continue doing those things and to find new ways. I'm super glad that some of our young people have been reaching out to ministries and working in some of these things. I want to encourage us wherever we can and whenever we can to continue being responsible to those needs.